This is a production of Cornell University.
We are sort of continuing now this theme that's intermittent throughout this semester on climate change and horticulture. And today we have with us Steve Shaw, who's did his work before graduate school. He worked for an engineering firm in New York City. New York City water infrastructure planning. So he's had a background in hydrology and water issues for a long time. He did his PhD here at Cornell in the BEE, Biological and Environmental Engineering Department. His focus there was on pollutant transport and urbanizing landscapes. And more recently, since completing his PhD, he's been working with the Water Resources Institute and in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for about the last year and a half, working with Susan Riha and that whole group over there. I know Steve because we both have been involved on a state-funded project funded by NYSERDA, looking at climate change vulnerabilities and adaptation strategies for different sectors of society and the environment. And Steve's the lead author on the Water Resources Report for that project, which will be final report should be coming out late this fall. I'm sure Steve will be telling us quite a bit about that. So with that introduction, I'll turn it over to Steve.
So a few qualifiers on this talk. First thing, I'm not a horticulturist in any way. I'm not even a very good hobby gardener. My garden pretty much died after my vacation in July and never watered it again. So my perspective isn't really going to be a horticultural perspective, other than just the linkages between water and growing things, which is basically limited to the lack of water, drought, leads to water stress, and potentially too much water, flooding, can lead to damage to fields, things like that. So really, most of the emphasis of the talk is just going to be on water resources. But more broadly, what it's really going to be about is really more of a critique of the way people assess impacts to water resources. And sort of, and it's really more of a critique of sort of an area that's been around for a while, but I'll just kind of call it climate impact studies, which is sort of its own kind of little niche area. That's kind of characterized by four different things. And I won't really say these are all positive characteristics either. And I'll really, this will kind of be the talk to kind of get into this a little bit about sort of the problems and basically the lack of sort of recognition of uncertainty that remains in terms of making predictions on water resources and climate change. And just sort of the root of some of those problems really comes from these four things I was thinking about this over the evening. The first thing is that this climate impact studies, the one thing they really like to focus on is adaptation. So early on when we were talking about climate change, more of the thinking was just understanding, you know, fundamentally what was going on. But a lot of the thinking was to put into, well, how do we prevent this from happening? So that's mitigation. And in some ways, if you're doing climate modeling, it doesn't really matter so much if you're exactly ready for mitigating, because you're trying to model something you don't ever want to happen in the first place. So as long as the possibility of it happening is realistic, hopefully you mitigate before anything really bad happens, and you never exactly find out. But when you shift your emphasis to adaptation, that really shifts the emphasis of what you're doing. You're pretty much saying, well, we think things are going to happen, and they're going to have negative consequences, and we want to start planning for them now. But this really raises the bar in terms of what we need to know. Because if we're trying to adapt for something, and we're making, you know, specific, really tangible plans, we're installing infrastructure, we're changing the way our policies and regulations, and we turn out to be wrong, well, that's a much bigger deal. And then a few other kind of elements of climate impact studies that I'd say are somewhat troubling is that one thing, it's multidisciplinary. And I use the term multidisciplinary distinctly different than interdisciplinary, which a lot of the time implies it's sort of a hybrid of different fields, you're drawing the best of different knowledge from different places. But by multidisciplinary, it sort of implies in a way that there's more kind of one unidirectional connections between different fields. And that's how I feel a lot of times kind of going on here, is that we're really highly reliant on what the atmospheric science community provides in terms of their general circulation models, GCMs also called, or global circulation models also called general climate models. And what has sort of happened, and this is one thing I'll really get into in the talk, is that we've really become overly reliant, well, highly reliant on what these GCMs are giving us as output to people in sort of secondary fields. So people who are hydrologists or ecologists your people in agronomy. We're really highly dependent on what the global climate modelers are giving us, and we really don't have really a lot of our own knowledge in that discipline to critically assess what they're giving us. And then a few other kind of complicating factors is one thing with these climate impact studies, we're really being pressed to provide information to people, kind of what we refer to sometimes as actionable information, information people can use. And in some ways, we're kind of jumping the gun. We're kind of probably putting things out there before it's necessarily ready. Okay, so those are just sort of some background features. And the way the talk is kind of organized is that the thing I thought I'd start with is sort of some standard answers. For sort of one thing, you know, that is typical to think about for horticulture agronomy is basically what's going to happen during the growing season, and are we going to have a water deficit? And in some ways, I would say that we can answer this relatively well. But this serves as sort of a nice counterpoint to some of the kind of questions beyond that, which I would sort of say are more the extreme cases of things, which we really are almost probably more interested in. Because we're really also interested in severe droughts, where you really see severe decreases in yield of crops and things like that. And really, answering this question doesn't really answer the question of necessarily what's going to happen with more severe conditions. So multi-year droughts or even, you know, really severe droughts within a single year. So we'll first kind of tackle this question, and just kind of, the one thing I like about this is that it is sort of independent to some degree of using the GCL output. But then what we'll get into is answering those bigger questions of the extremes, and we'll really then start talking about how people are using the GCMs, how the GCMs aren't necessarily giving you what you want, and sort of a direction to proceed in order to get better information to make those decisions. Okay, so our place to start is just what's the likelihood of water deficits during the growing season, basically the next 100 years. That's sort of the typical time frame people use. And really for the talk, I'm basically going to focus on the Northeast and kind of the East Coast. So there's a relatively notable paper from about 3 years ago by Hago et al. I think she's in Texas somewhere. And they did climate modeling for the Northeast. And I would generally say this is probably one of the best papers out there in terms of really doing a pretty good job. So what this slide is basically presenting is, well, it's presenting droughts, and we'll talk about what exactly they mean by that. So it's basically it's looking at droughts for a 1 to 3 month period, a 3 to 6 month period, and 6 months plus. And it's doing it for two different time periods, 1961 to 1990, and then 2070 to 2099. So basically a 100-year shift in between. And the colors basically indicate the frequency of those drought occurrences. So basically, as it gets to be more yellow, orange, or red, you have more of those occurring. So you can see as you shift between 1960 and 1990 to 2070, 2099, you basically have an increase in the number of droughts. And so the interesting thing to kind of keep in mind with this is there's lots of ways to define drought. And really, the way to define drought here is basically just based on soil moisture. So a 10% decline in mean monthly soil moisture. And then they're also doing this for relatively short periods of time. So the way they're defining drought here is certainly relevant to agriculture. This would be the kind we're most interested in. And this is sort of, and this is done basically by using the GCMs. This is based on GCM output modeling the soil column and how much moisture is there. And you can clearly see, well, things are going to get drier. One question you might ask, and I'm not necessarily going to answer it, is a 10% decrease all that important in terms of yields? It probably go down that much, but it's not really as dramatic as severe drought, which is really is what we're going to talk about there. So there's a few different ways to justify this. And this is one reason to kind of work through this is, so the models themselves tell you this is what's going to happen. But you can also justify this in a few different other lines of argument. So basically what we're saying is, for the Northeast, overall, we're not actually projecting much of a change in total annual rainfall. So what we're really just projecting is a change in the way the moisture is basically distributed over the year. So first thing we're likely to see, and this is independent of the GCMs, this is just looking at other data sources, is that there's going to be a shift in timing basically of snowmelt. This is Julian Day on the y-axis, and then this is year on the x-axis, and this is the center of the discharge volume on 13 unregulated streams in New England. And it's basically showing that as you move up to current time, the Julian day at which you basically have your peak flows in your system are becoming earlier in the season. And then it's basically because things are getting warmer earlier, things are melting earlier, and we're basically having a shift. So basically what that means is the systems are generally drying out a little earlier in the season. So if you're talking about, you know, what's happening in the growing season, well, basically things are drying out a little bit more before you get there. We have a few other things happening with climate change, or at least what people are projecting. One thing they're projecting is you basically have a shift in the frequency of rainfall events. And the reason we're basically seeing this, and this is also, this is people kind of reach this conclusion independent of the models, and the models also show this. But one way they kind of reach this conclusion is that overall the hydrologic cycle, sort of the intensity of the hydrologic cycle, is basically dependent on the amount of net radiation coming into the system. So sort of our annual precipitation, which on sort of a long-term basis is going to be equivalent to ET, is going to be pretty much equal to our net radiation. And that's not really going to change that much with climate change. But the one thing, but in terms of event precipitation, that's going to be highly dependent on temperature at the time of the rainfall event. So what you can do is you can establish, again, just kind of empirically looking at data, the relationship between mean daily temperature and rainfall intensity. And there's actually a few different things that will affect rainfall intensity. But it actually turns out that mean daily temperature does a pretty good job of predicting kind of extreme rainfall amounts. So we sort of see that as temperatures get a little higher, and these different lines indicate 99.9 percentile rainfall or 99 percentile rainfall, that your rainfall intensity is going to increase with temperature. But the constraint here is that this relationship increases in kind of extreme intensities at a greater rate than change in net radiation will increase kind of mean annual rainfall. So what this basically shows is this is a distribution of rainfall in the course of the year in terms of percentile. And the main thing to look at here, and then this is the intensity of this axis, and the main thing to look at here is the ratio. So what we basically see here is we see, and this is the ratio between kind of our control situation, so current conditions. This is increased CO2, so basically 100 years out. And this basically is showing that there's an increase in the number of high-intensity events. And basically because the high-intensity events are increasing at a faster rate than just sort of the mean, that means that somewhere you have to make up. Your mass balance has to close. So it basically closes by losing your low-intensity. So then what that leads to, what that necessarily has to mean, is if you have more high-intensity events, the same amount of rainfall, less low-intensity events, the frequency of your rainfall events is going to decrease. So then the other kind of element of how much or how much water do you have in your system in the summer. So you have your precipitation coming in, you have the component going out, and that's mostly due to evapotranspiration. And I'd like to talk about this one. I've been working on a paper on this recently. And the interesting thing about this is in some ways people, I think, exaggerate how much ET might change in the change of climate. ET will go up, but not by that much. And one reason people kind of get a little bit confused is that ET isn't very easy to measure directly. So precipitation, you can just have a rain gauge, you can measure it directly. Stream discharge, you know, you can go out, you can gauge a stream, you can measure it directly. But something like ET, you can't really measure directly. There's pan, you can do pan evaporation. If you talk to a hydrologist, most people say that isn't really reliable. There's issues with that. So if you go in a hydrology textbook, there's tens to, I don't know, hundreds of equations to estimate ET. And people haven't been very good at distinguishing between how much they'll change. So what this graph shows is it shows percentage change in ET with increasing temperature. So you can see some methods of estimating ET indicate really high percentages change in ET. Others, and these, Penry, Monteith, Priestley, Taylor, are really considered more kind of physically based, realistic ones, project relatively small changes in ET. And I'd like to just bring this up, because especially in sort of, at the very beginning I said, you know, people like to do these climate impact studies, and one thing they push for is to put information out there for the general public. And this is, a lot of the time when you read those, without really much kind of qualification, they say, well, ET is going to increase basically due to warmer temperatures. And really, it's not that true. I mean, we tend to think that ET is, as things get a lot hotter, ET will increase a lot more. But really, ET is more highly dependent on your net radiation in your system. So what this is, I'll do this for corn. That was for trees, but I'll use my data for corn. So the way to really look at this is to basically do the relationship between ET and temperature, when you're controlling for net radiation, and then do the relationship between ET and net radiation when you're controlling for temperature. So this one over here is ET versus temperature, or controlling for net radiation. So the clusters are similar net radiation values. And you basically see there's really no relationship between temperature and ET. I mean, if you drew a regression line, they'd basically be flat. But what you see instead is for net radiation versus temperature, basically all the, no matter kind of what temperature you pick, all the lines basically collapse on top of one another, and you clearly have a nice regression line. So what this really shows, and it's an important point to make, is that most of your changes, if you're going to have changes in ET, are going to be dependent on changes in net radiation, which really aren't going to be that dramatic. But changes in temperature are going to be more dramatic. And that's basically because, what's going to happen is we're going to have, in terms of the greenhouse effect, there'll be more long-wave radiation coming in, but as the Earth heats up, there'll be more long-wave radiation going out. So you'll kind of reach a new equilibrium point with higher temperatures, but your net radiation won't really change that much. So in terms of going back to this figure, so this is back to sort of my point of the models. It's realistic that the models gave us this, and we could sort of say, well, we expect to see this independent of the models for a few different reasons. Partially because things are wetting or drying out sooner. ET might increase a little bit, but not that much. And then the third one is possibly the change in the intensity of the rainfall. So this is sort of two different things, the models and sort of those independent analyses kind of lead us to think, we can be pretty confident in this. But really the place I want to go with the rest of the talk is how models are getting used for something that's not really that simple, for really the more complicated questions, which are the extremes. So basically when we start to talk about it, does anyone know when the most severe drought in the Northeast was? 1960s. And we'll look at the data a little bit, but basically from 63 to 65, we had rainfall deficits on the order of 10 inches per year. So we usually only have 35 to 40 inches per year, so we're almost a third off our rate. So when you start talking about things that could really impact yields, you really want to know, is that kind of event going to happen or not? And this is where I really say we're not really getting there well, but we're not necessarily always telling people we're not getting there. And a lot of this comes down to, in order to estimate something like that, we can't really use the arguments we were using before just for growing season soil moisture deficit. So what we're using is we're just relying on the GCM. And sort of there's a formulaic way they get implemented. It's basically, you have your general circulation model, and it basically operates at a pretty large resolution, so a 500 kilometer grid cell resolution. And so if you think about a 500 kilometer grid cell resolution, you're basically talking about something that's the size of New York State, pretty much. So in order to kind of do anything with that at a useful scale, you need to downscale that. So you use what's called a regional climate model. And that'll give you some of the more kind of standard weather patterns you're used to seeing. So sort of frontal systems moving through, things like that. It doesn't exactly reproduce those, but it kind of reproduces the signature of those. And then those are kind of get fed into kind of what I refer to as a local process model. So a hydrologic model, maybe some kind of crop growth model, things like that. Okay, so the thing is, well, it seems nice. You can write out the equations for this. You can do the models. But in some ways, this is sort of where you start running into trouble, is because in some ways it's pretty easy to do this. And then it becomes kind of hard to ask questions, or hard to be critical. So one reason it's sort of so easy to do this is because, kind of in an ideal way, well, scientists say, well, we should share data. So we have, and we should, especially talking about climate change, since it's such a major issue, we should kind of have joint discussions about what's going on. So we have the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And one thing they have coming out of that is they have what's called the Couple Model Intercomparison Project. So basically all the national labs for different countries, and it's basically it's the G8 plus Australia, Norway, Korea, China, they all basically have their own climate models, and all their data gets posted on the web. And anybody who wants can basically go and download this data. Which, well, it seems like a great thing. We're all scientists, the more you can share data, the better. And in general, it is a good thing. But what it sort of gets back to is when I started saying, well, you have this multidisciplinary issue. Well, you basically have this GCM output That's one thing. I should actually never even call it data. It's really just output. It's not data. You basically have this GCM output from these complicated algorithms that are really being used by atmospheric scientists to answer some of their own questions specifically for atmospheric science, but weren't really always intended to be used to downscale to just a 1 kilometer grid cell representation of what's going on in a very specific place. And this information is certainly being used. So this is just a chart of, this is date on the bottom, from November 04 to January 09 here. And then this is gigabytes downloaded per day. And we're at around, 700 gigabytes per day being downloaded. So there's lots of people relying on this. And if you look through the academic literature, there's lots of people writing papers using these data sets. So there are three different issues with this. I mean, one is the fact that most people using it aren't climate scientists and really don't have that good of an understanding of the limitations of it. And no one's really saying, in some ways, by putting the data out there, there's really nobody saying, well, you shouldn't just take this and use it how you want. A second issue with this is basically the number of kind of model runs available. So there's about, I think there's 20 or 21 GCMs that are typically used. And one thing this leads to is basically people know there's uncertainty. But then what they say is, well, we have 21 model runs from 21 different independent models being developed by different people. And they also all have these different emission scenarios. So basically different projections of how much greenhouse gas is going to be released in the atmosphere in the next 100 years. So doesn't this suite of different emission scenarios and models kind of give us a wide enough range to look at, to kind of quantify our possible uncertainty? So that's one, and that's how it usually gets used, is that people will say, take the model output and just kind of take the mean of what the 21 GCMs give them. So this is for one of the emission scenarios, the A2 scenario, which is sort of on the track of the trajectory we're on to in terms of our emissions. And the interesting thing to note here is the area I circled is sort of the range of uncertainty, and this is just for global temperature, if you use your 21 GCMs, which is the typical thing to do. Now, if you start to do to add other kind of uncertainties that are typically left out, starting to include other processes, so the one that's being included now more often is the carbon cycle, then you start to see a much broader range of uncertainty, which is basically the gray bar here. So instead of going from a global temperature projection in 2099, somewhere 3 degrees plus or minus 1 degree, you're somewhere more 3 degrees plus or minus 2 degrees. So people should maybe be a little concerned that your band of uncertainty is pretty big. And this is just temperature. This is sort of what the models should really be best able to do. And a further point on this, which I'll talk about just a little bit, is this is from the IPCC report, is it notes that the upper bound is less certain than the lower bound. But the upper bound is really the bound we're more interested in, because that's sort of what's the worst case scenario. So, separate from the IPCC report, using the GCMs, some people have thought a little bit about sort of the implications of what is the upper bound. And they thought about that just even using very simple models. So this is basically almost the simplest model we could have in terms of temperature change. And this is basically saying delta T is a change in global mean global temperature, and then it relates it to mean global net radiation times a scalar, and then there's this feedback term, which basically says there's feedback. So you guys, global temperature gets bigger, there's a positive feedback, and that actually drives it even higher. So depending on what this feedback term is in this simple model, really depends, will drive what the maximum change of global temperature is. And you would kind of think, well, if you can really easily constrain it, just using a simple distribution, say a normal distribution, how out of hand can your delta T get? Well, you can show just using really simple math, and it's sort of presented just graphically down here. If you assume your feedback term is normally distributed, somewhere around 0.6, that as you really can, the tail really gets very long in terms of what the delta T actually is. So if you just look at the mean, it might be, well, this 3-degree change. But there's a relatively high probability of any getting anywhere up to 10, 12, 14-degree change. If not out of the realm of possibility. So this is sort of another area of concern of only using the GCMs and kind of using this middle range here, kind of saying, okay, well, we kind of calculate, you know, we account for some uncertainty, things are going to be somewhere in the middle there. A lot of the times, we never really grapple with the question of, you know, what happens if we're at these farther ranges farther out. So just to kind of get a little sense of, you know, how do we go about thinking about this, I just put up sort of a simple kind of psychology game here. So basically say that you have, someone says, okay, you're going to draw from a bowl, and you're going to, you know, draw four balls labeled A, B, C, or D. So which game do you want to play? And this is the amount of money you would win or have taken from your bank account if you play this game. And this, I would say, so this is a pretty good kind of simple representation of kind of playing the climate change game and how we probably need to kind of change the way we think about what we're dealing with. So what game would people want to play? If you play game one, you can either win $50,000, $30,000, or $10,000, or have $90,000 taken out of your bank account if you have that much, or just be in debt for that much. And just the thing to note is the overall expected value is still only zero. That if you kind of think about it in the probability of, you know, what if you could play this game over and over, what's the, you know, what, where would you come out? Well, you come out only losing $0. Game two is you get 10,000, or you get 2,000, you get 1,000, you get minus 2,000, minus 4,000. The expected value is minus 3,000. So if you could play this game over and over and over, you ultimately end up with minus 3,000. So sort of in traditional terms, if you talk to an economist, they'd say, well, and if you basically knew you could play this thing over and over, you'd clearly go for game one. But what would people do if you knew you could only play this game once? Where would people fall? Yeah, I mean, most people are going to say they're going to play game two. And this is sort of the same kind of thinking that, to some degree, isn't really applied, but maybe should be applied more often in terms of thinking about climate change. That since we really can only play this game once, and since it's possible, we're going to be some, you know, you have this kind of long tail possibility of being somewhere out there in terms of things change. Maybe people kind of need to devise their strategies of what they're doing a little differently than they are when people just sort of get caught up in terms of quantifying their uncertainty just within this sort of narrow range there. And using just sort of the standard GCM output as the possible, as the only possibility of where things can go. And just to sort of say, when people you know, start thinking about, well, you might say this range for your F is too high. But if you really start to talk about you know, geologists or scientists or something, they say that's not really true at all, because you have lots of things that could really lead to these strong positive feedbacks. So like one is the methane hydrates of those escaping the atmosphere. You know, so people can come up with a list of sort of reasonable things that could happen that could really strengthen the feedback to this degree. So they're not out of the realm of possibility. Okay, so that's sort of one point to make in terms of thinking about extremes with the GCMs. The other thing to be said, which I really haven't said, is that, and I actually don't even show up directly here, but I get to it a little bit from what happened with temperature, that if we can't really trust temperature predictions overall, how can we possibly trust rainfall? Because it's kind of commonly acknowledged that rainfall is much harder to predict than temperature. And I would sort of say we can't very well. And part of the problem is we don't even really have a very good way to really validate the models, to validate the GCMs. So what I'm going to talk about just a little bit next is what might be a possible way to do a better job of sort of validating the GCMs, or kind of leading to a line of thinking about drought and flooding sort of external to the GCMs. And one place this all starts is really thinking, kind of reconceptualizing the way we think about how moisture is moving around. I mean, when you start to use the GCMs, one thing that kind of happens is you just kind of become stuck on, you know, what's the precipitation value it's telling you. But you kind of lose track of the big picture. Is that in a lot of cases, well, first thing is that with climate change, the hydrologic cycle is basically intensified. So if anything, that basically means you basically have more rainfall, the whole cycle is going faster. And if anything, on a global scale, you don't have less precipitation. The main thing is that it's just going different places. And if you start to look at, well, how well do people really understand moisture transfers in the atmosphere, you realize they don't understand them very well. And it's really only in the last few years that there's really been any papers out there that have kind of looked at moisture transfers. So I like this one. This is interesting. So this is shows a picture of the globe flattened out. And what these, the yellow, the oranges, the reds indicate is basically that these are areas where we have that it's basically the recycle ratio. So how much of the moisture falling on that region comes from that region itself. And you can see that the areas with the high recycling ratios are over the oceans, right? And the places with low recycling ratios are over the continents. So the main thing this picture is telling you is that most of the continents, most of the moisture coming into the continents is coming from somewhere else. So we need to understand where else that's coming from. So this is sort of one thing I've been starting to do, but I'm really not very far into it. So I'm using someone else's figures for this. But this is just a paper from 2010, just this year, of someone finally kind of digging into where is this moisture coming from. So what they did is they identified, using models, but kind of working backwards in the model, regions where you basically have most of the moisture contributions to kind of the global hydrologic cycle. And then just looking at, I was just interested in North America Armadillo. It's kind of interesting to work backwards and see where is most of the moisture coming from. So this is just for June, July, August, so summer months. And then as the colors go up to the blue, up to purple, that means there's more moisture coming from that region. So we can see in the summer months, a good portion of our moisture is coming from the North Atlantic. A good portion is coming from kind of the Gulf and the Caribbean. And a little bit of our moisture is coming from the Pacific Ocean. So as you start thinking this way, though, it really changes your way of thinking about and giving you a place to validate the GCMs. So instead of just saying, instead of just taking the GCM as sort of as whatever the output is and assuming that's the right thing, I mean, the one thing you can really start to do, which people haven't really done that much, is really look at what the GCM, say, for 2100 is projecting where that moisture should come from. And does that make sense? So that's sort of a direction to go. But without even going there, that's something to work on. Something that would sort of start to send you in that direction is, and that I've actually have been working on, is the issue of flooding. So let me just talk about this for a few minutes. So flooding's interesting. So this is a set of peak stream flows. This is year on the plot x-axis and discharge on the y-axis. And this is for the Susquehanna River just outside of Binghamton. And if you looked at this, you might say that if you knew climate change was kind of happening, you know, we know there's been, you know, about a 1 degree increase in the last 50 years. And now we're getting, in the last 10 years, we get these huge peak flows, and we get the largest flow by about 20,000 CFS cubic feet per second in about 2006 out of the Susquehanna. You might think this is pretty good evidence for climate change leading to increased flooding. So sort of the question, going back to, can we do a better job of sort of tracking where moisture is coming from, how it's happening, is to sort of help answer that question. Is that due to climate change or not? So this, and the standard approach to kind of answer this question has basically been a statistical approach. So pretty much what you do, or is what a hydrologist or a statistician would do, is go back to the historical record, get the peak stream flows each year, and then fit a probability distribution to it. So the one thing that's really lacking in this is it really has no sense of process. And you have really no sense of what were the conditions that led to that flooding. And it sort of makes good sense for why it was initially done this way. Because people really started doing this maybe 50, 60 years ago, when your stream records were probably only 20 or 25 years long at best. So they didn't really have much to work with. And you also didn't really have very good meteorological observations. The thing you could rely on most was your stream flow. But now we're basically 50 or 60 years later, we basically have 100 years of stream record. We can really do a better job. So this is somewhat of a complicated figure, but I'll explain it. So one thing I've been looking at is basically a different way of sort of looking at why floods happen and what sort of the root cause of this. So in the chart here, the blue diamonds indicate a flood that's a result of the annual maximum rainfall for a given year. And this is Julian Day, so it tells you sort of the day it happened, and then on the y-axis is discharge, so it gives you a sense of discharge. Okay, so the green crosses are discharges on a stream resulting from the two-day annual maximum snowmelt, and then the red boxes are just the actual annual maximum discharge on the stream. So basically, when you have a red box that's surrounding either a blue diamond or a green cross, then you know that that was the cause of the flood. But otherwise, the flood would result from something else. So you really quickly here see that most flooding isn't caused by increases in rainfall intensity, which is sort of the common explanation for why people think flooding will increase. So it's an explanation applied everywhere. It might be true in some places, but it would suggest it's not necessarily true in New York State. And it doesn't, in most cases, snowmelt isn't related to flooding either. In most cases, what's related to flooding is, and well, a lot of your cases of peak flows are sort of late springtime. You basically have, you just had snowmelt, things have dried out, things have warmed up enough, though, to get a lot of moisture in the atmosphere, and then you have a relatively big storm. So you basically have moderate rainfall amounts and wet soils. So that's sort of been, in New York, you might say that's sort of the root cause of most of the annual maximum discharges we see. So this is sort of, you know, a way of rethinking, instead of just saying, okay, the GCM data says we're going to have more precipitation, this must mean we're going to have more flooding. It's really a way to dig into the processes and kind of get at what's really going on. So instead, we might kind of reinterpret this and say, well, the GCMs or any kind of just thinking about climate change is saying things might also dry out earlier in the springtime. So it's sort of possible that the window when things are wet will narrow, and maybe we'll actually have less floods because we'll dry out sooner in the springtime. So just kind of thinking along these lines kind of gets you away from the GCM and kind of is an independent way to kind of think about what might happen in terms of water resources. And this is also an interesting set. This is work that's being done at Princeton. And this is, so it's just a little bit more on floods. But this is what they did, is they looked at floods at about 500 stream discharge stations on the East Coast. And this one is floods in March and April, or annual maximum discharges in March and April. So you can see, especially up here, kind of clearly kind of what I was showing, that a lot of these are sort of related to snowmelt or kind of these late spring flooding. This is floods due to hurricanes. And you can see that in most regions, especially in New York, we're not subject to very many hurricanes. Really, that's really more down in the Carolinas, Southern Florida. And then this is floods due to, in June, July, August, which is sort of a proxy for big convective storms, big thunderstorms. And again, you can see that New York, and especially the upper Northeast, we really don't have many floods due to the largest rainfall events, big convective storms. But then a little bit in the Midwest, more really in Appalachia, in Appalachian Mountains, that's really considered some major events, and then South Florida. So again, this sort of points you in a direction of, say you're looking at climate change and you're looking at the GCMs and kind of want to validate things. Well, if you want to kind of know what's going to happen with your annual discharges in some place like the Carolinas, you really need to know what's going to go on with hurricanes. So unless you think your GCMs can tell you what's going on with hurricanes, then you're not going to get very far in terms of predicting flooding. And most people would say, just about everyone would say in atmospheric scientists that GCMs can't tell you what's going to go on with hurricanes. So it's sort of an example of where we're kind of out of luck. Okay, so then just the thing to finish with is droughts. And really for crop production, I mean, this is really what we're interested in. But the thing with droughts that sort of makes it, with floods, you really have something to work with. Because you at least have an annual maximum every year. You have high flows happen a lot more often on a stream. And so you have more data, basically. But with really severe droughts, we don't have much data. One thing we can look at a little bit is we can look at paleo climatological records. So this shows two paleo records from the Northeast. This is Chesapeake Bay sediment cores. This is tree ring records in the Hudson Valley. And one thing it clearly shows is that the 1960s drought, with both these records, was, at least in terms of duration and intensity, really the most severe drought we've had in the last 300 years. The really interesting thing to look is, this paper is 1977, which showed this. And this was in Science, and if you kind of follow up on the citations of who cited that since then, basically no climatologists have cited that paper, and certainly nobody in terms of water resources. So sort of, even though we kind of know this piece of information, and we kind of have what we can say, well, this is, that was the most severe drought in 300 years, people really haven't worked it into thinking about what are the implications for water resources. And they certainly haven't really worked it into thinking about can the GCMs reproduce this now, or can they reproduce it in the future? And they can't. And just a little bit more to show this kind of same point, just one other thing, is to also just look at sort of rainfall deficits at different points in New York for different dry years. And this sort of shows, it just shows things a little differently. So these are basically the driest years on record in the last century. And even kind of our difference between upstate and downstate. The 60s drought was consistently dry everywhere. But then you also have other events that really only were downstate or only were upstate. And even just kind of looking at something really as simple as just New York, if you try to kind of pin down why was it only downstate, why was it only upstate, it's pretty hard to explain that. So sort of my main argument with this is really until we can explain, you know, relatively kind of local things like this, just kind of the difference between upstate and downstate for kind of historical time, we're going to have a pretty hard, it's going to be pretty difficult to predict what's going to go on 100 years out from now. Okay, so I kind of was all over the place, really, in terms of where I was going. So just to kind of a few, kind of to refocus things, just a few kind of final messages here in terms of just sort of thoughts on you know, how to predict what will happen with water resources. First thing to say, just sort of, you know, in some ways I was sort of somewhat critical of the climate models. They're certainly useful, but for the right thing. So they're certainly useful for testing hypotheses related to climate science, and also for really demonstrating potential impacts for mitigation. But as I sort of said earlier, when we start to shift this to wanting to inform adaptation, where we want to do something very specific, we want to direct specific resources to a specific spot, it becomes much more troublesome because really the accuracy just probably isn't there. A third thing is the uncertainty by having those GCMs, and basically, especially by having a lot of them, this gives us sort of a false sense that we are covering the level of uncertainty within them. But especially as I kind of showed with looking at the long tails, I would say that's certainly not the case. Any model-based conclusions need to be sort of supported by plausible process-based calculations. I would sort of say for the first thing I showed, I kind of tried to clearly say that, was for thinking that we're going to have water deficit in just the growing season, you can kind of back that up based on the GCMs and other independent lines of analysis. But for things like drought and flood, we don't really have those other independent lines of analysis. We're kind of still working our way through those. The possibility of very long tail outcomes, so those rare outcomes, should be considered more carefully. I would say really right now in terms of adaptation planning, people, it's sort of off the radar in terms of thinking about that and sort of thinking about how would we you know, structure adaptations. In some cases, you might say, well, if things are really that bad, then we're going to just, everything's going to be different, so what's the point? In some cases, that might be true. In other cases, especially for kind of essentials like water supply, probably we can't just kind of be that dismissive. And then the final thing, it seems like it kind of at the point where we know we're doing a better job of sort of handling uncertainty, is when we actually see somewhere in a report that someone will say, this time impacts to this region remain too uncertain to offer any reasonable actionable information. That I've never seen anybody really state that before. That usually people put something out there, and it's kind of up for interpretation whether you trust it or not. But most of the time, no one's going to say this. So when people finally start saying that, I'll kind of feel better about how everybody's thinking about projecting that in terms of climate change. Okay, that's it for me. So if anybody has questions, we'll be happy to.
Very well done. Glad I've been paying attention along the line so I could sort of keep track of what can be fairly complicated, which goes to my point of, you know, people that I deal with that grow grass for a living. We've been seeing consistently, as your data indicates, that we're getting more intense storms, more separated apart. Average rainfall looks the same month after month, and yet rains on the 2nd of June and not again until the 30th of June. And so you look at the monthly average and you're getting your rainfall. But we're becoming more reliant on our irrigation systems, right, to keep the grass green or functional or whatever, whether it's our landscape or crops.
Yep.
So I want to know, what we've been saying from an extension educational program perspective is you better make sure you got good irrigation systems because it looks like it could be like this for a while. Now you're saying, may not be, but I mean, if we don't have something, if I make that last statement, I'm telling you, people are never going to change what they're going to do. We have to have some way. motivate them for change.
In terms of that last statement, in terms of something like growing season water deficit, I mean, as I sort of said, you know, there's multiple lines of argument that you can, and that sort of all point in the same direction. But if you, it's to say, well, you might be able to justify irrigation if you know you're going to have, you know, your crop is sensitive to only 2 months, you know, if things dry down in 2 weeks, it's sensitive to that. If you have irrigation, you can prevent that. But if you're sort of saying, but if you're using irrigation to get by a big multi-year drought, that becomes a different issue. And then the type of irrigation also becomes different. Because if you're saying, okay, we're just dealing with a two-week dry down, you basically still have water in the streams, you still have groundwater to pull from, you just need to get into the plants. That's one thing.
Right.
But if your question becomes, you have a multi-year drought, you're going to try to keep your plants at a relative high yield for 3 years, then it's like, do you even have the water there to pull from? And that's a totally different question. And I would say, in that case, then somebody should probably say, we don't know. Right?
Well, but at the same time, we use this to sort of, and from an educational perspective, we use it to motivate them to move in a direction we'd like them to move in anyway, which is more efficient systems, grasses that are more adapted to more hostile environments, whether they be wet or dry. So in some ways, I feel like, without, you know, scaring everybody to death, there's some reason why it's important to say things are looking like they're moving in this way, and if you make choices that they're going to make you more efficient whether it happens or not.
I would agree. And I think, I mean, that's, and especially where you have, you know, just the issue of short-term water deficit. I mean, there's good evidence that that's happening or going in that direction. So you have good reason to say you should do irrigation. And if it also has some secondary benefit for longer-term droughts, more sustained droughts, that's so be it. I mean, and then you sort of have, you know, sometimes we talk about kind of no regrets solutions, things like that. And that's a good example of where you have those. But if you're only doing irrigation because someone's telling you that the possibility of long-term droughts increasing, then you have to sort of reassess that. So I think when you hit it, like a situation like yours, you probably can justify it because, you know, kind of, you know, it has a benefit no matter what.
Right.
But if it's sort of questions where it doesn't have a benefit no matter what, then you really need to start from somewhere else to think about it.
I have a question about that part where you were talking about the potential ET versus temperature and versus net radiation.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about that, it seemed like you were talking about humid regions of the world, like Rosemont, Minnesota,
yeah,
and the Northeast. And I'm wondering if that relationship or the lack of the relationship on the left side also holds under more arid conditions.
Probably not. This is specific just to humid regions.
To regions that generally have adequate rainfall.
Yeah, I mean, and especially, well, I didn't show the tree data either. I mean, it's also true for trees, but we're also looking at humid regions with citrus forest. So, yeah, I'd have to rethink that if you're in arid regions. But yeah, I would say it's not universally applicable.
The feedback factor that you had for temperature.
Yes.
How did you get that range, I guess, or the distribution?
Oh, how did they get this range?
Yeah.
I think they probably just said it's around 6 and, you know, 2 standard deviation of 0.1, or around 0.6 with a standard deviation of 0.1, something like that.
Was there a physical basis?
Well, I think, yeah, as I was sort of saying with the, on the upper range, you know, there's with methane hydrates, things like that.
Okay.
You know, they sort of said, well, it's physically possible to get out to that range.
Okay.
But yeah, I know in terms of this paper, they were just sort of, you know, they wanted some plausibility for the range they had, but they just kind of threw it out there as possible.
Yeah,
Jeff.
Thank you. Sort of the same graph. It seemed like the implication you seem to be drawing from it was there's a lot of action going on in that long tail. It seemed like you were saying, but so we can't really tell people that they've got a problem coming with these rising temperatures. But in fact, the issue there is that it could be much worse than we think.
No, that's right. I mean, that was sort of.
So if you, with that in mind, sort of with the gentleman who's back here talking about the grasses and irrigation, I mean, to emphasize the point that it's very likely to be this bad and could be worse than that, I mean, is giving people a clue that they need to respond. as opposed to saying, well, we really can't tell them exactly how bad it is, so we're not going to tell them they need to do anything.
Well, I didn't imply that you shouldn't tell them anything. I mean, so there are a few different kind of levels of things going on. In some cases, you just tell them, you know, you don't really know. In some cases, though, you're sort of playing this game, that, if, you know, you might just say, well, we don't really know, but you need a different way to think about how you're going to end up doing this. And so that might just kind of imply, however you go about doing this isn't sort of as orderly as some people make it seem. Like, oh, you can kind of do the, you know, the cost-benefit analysis. This is what's going to happen. You can figure out a cost-benefit analysis on, you know, this level of irrigation, and we can come up with a nice answer. Okay, this is the cost-benefit analysis. This is the way to go. So really say, you know, we really need to be much more broader thinking in terms of how bad things can get. So the one case where I sometimes think about this is, really for more for water supply. So as a quick example for that, like right now, New York City gets basically most of their water from the Catskill Mountains, their watershed up there. They have in the past drawn water out of the Hudson River, but they're not permitted to do so now. And it's not really, and it doesn't seem like they're making an attempt to pull water out of the Hudson River. One reason why is because the Hudson River is an estuary, it's brackish, and there's some issue. So basically they think the salt front would move up the river. And if New York City wants to pull water, that would also mean Poughkeepsie might also have to pull water out, that would also be brackish. But the interesting thing with that is what do they define as brackish? And right now they're defining brackish as 100 milligrams per liter ppm of chloride. The federal standard for chloride is secondary standard, which just means a recommended standard, is 200 ppm. And you could, and places probably in Australia, other places probably drink a lot of this 500 ppm chloride. So the question, you know, so that's sort of, in terms of sort of expanding your range of thinking what's acceptable, this would sort of be an example of that. If we know you might have a long tail, things that could really go bad, but we're still kind of thinking in this more narrow range, you know, if you're thinking about things in a longer tail, could you justify, you know, pulling water even if your chloride is going to be 500 ppm? I think you definitely could. But people aren't at that point where they're willing to make that argument.
Steve, this reminds me a little bit of, I've heard people use the analogy of people buying fire insurance for their homes, where it's, you know, what's the likelihood your house is really going to burn down? But most people are quite willing to make that investment just because they've only got one house and one life, and if your house burns down, they don't want to lose everything. So it's something like that. But people are willing to make those kind of investments, even though it's extremely unlikely their house is.
But this is exactly the problem. The problem is that's a very personal, at my location, impact my life thing. And some of this stuff is so big picture. It's hard to get your arms around it. And I'm telling you, somebody makes that last statement you think and hope people will make, nobody's going to change anything.
Well, I mean, it is true. I mean, you have kind of two different things working. I mean, you kind of have basically a PR kind of issue.
Psychology,
you want people to do something. But then you could also, I mean, the people who are doing the analysis, at some level, you need to be truthful to yourself of what you're actually seeing and what you're doing. I mean, and that's sort of this, you know, at the beginning when I was trying to describe kind of the climate impact studies, I mean, it's this middle region of policy and science, and it's also very public, I mean, kind of all at the same time. So you're trying to be objective, but at the same time, you know, people are going to be reading this, and you're trying to influence in terms of what they do, making them kind of more cautious and more willing to make changes. And it's a hard place to be in terms of, you know, being realistic about what we know, but also trying to make people prepare for having worst case. So I'd sort of say we need to get deeper into how we think about how we present that information.
So I have a couple of questions, one of which may be way too tangential to this. But the first one is, in the international data set, is there metadata available on that can be mined to move from sort of larger scale to more local scale models?
Not really. I mean, the methods people use for...
Repeat the question, please.
You should hear me. So in the international data set, like I guess the IPCC data set, like that, inter-model comparison, is there data that can be mined to kind of aid in validating the models of which finer scale processes?
Yes.
Yeah. Not exactly. I mean, there's a lot of local meteorological data you can use. I mean, there's other places, there's other things you can do to try to kind of validate what's going on to some degree. I mean, so I would say one thing, so a data set that's out there, it's called reanalysis data. So it basically is they use kind of the same grid cell scale that they use for the global climate models, but they take historical data and kind of put it on that same scale. So you could kind of use the reanalysis data, and you could look at something like basically the jet streams, the wind field, and kind of reproduce the jet streams, which is going to be a major indicator of how at least some moisture is moving in your system, and kind of see how well your GCMs are reproducing, you know, where you think moisture redistribution should go. So you could do something like that.
And the second question is, it seems like economists, in terms of your cost-benefit analysis and adaptation, right, are shifting their definition or changing their definition of utility to defining finite resources as finite as opposed to infinite. And does that change your concerns about adaptation at the local level?
So the question there was the way economists define their definition of utility in terms of having whether your resources are finite or infinite, which actually I really can't legitimately comment on that
because that's
too technical for me. I'm not a great economist. So there is. I was going to say there is a recent paper by some guy at Harvard, Weinstein or something like that, dealing just with this issue of how economists do cost benefit on long tails, which I kind of glanced at it skimmed through, but since I have no economy background, I really can't say too much. But if you're looking for, I can email it to you if you want, because it's an interesting paper, and he basically says the way economists are doing things, they're not doing a good job of accounting for fat tails, basically, in terms of how they do cost benefit. So.
What about from Geneva? Did we have any questions there?
Yes, actually, a comment on the ET question. I think, correctly, as you point out on the with low crops that have a heavy boundary layer over it, the Pendant Monteith is driven almost entirely by net radiation. So if the net radiation doesn't change much, you don't expect too much. But with taller crops like fruit trees and orchards, things like that are well coupled to the atmosphere, their ET is dependent on net radiation, but also on temperature, BPD, and stomatal conductance. So that might be a different case where we might expect to see a stronger effect of climate change in crops that are well coupled to the bulk atmosphere versus those that are relatively uncoupled.
So. Yeah, I think that's probably the case. With one thing I was looking at, I didn't show it here. It's kind of interesting. I was looking at data for trees, for deciduous forest, and I guess not necessarily expected, but BPD was kind of pretty well correlated with net radiation. So in some ways, even though you might think BPD would change, at least historically, BPD has kind of moved with net radiation pretty closely. I don't know if things would stay the same in the future. But so that was one thing that suggested net radiation might still be sort of a main indicator of how things might go. To extrapolate out to the future is kind of difficult.
Anything else here or Geneva? Any last question? Okay, if not, join with me in thanking Steve.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.